I'm going to begin the book of Esther. Esther 1, verses 1 through 3. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus, this is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 provinces, that in those days, when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace, in the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. First of all, we need to be aware of the time in which the book of Esther is written. Esther is describing for us a period of time somewhere between 486 and 465 B.C. That is nearly 500 years before Christ. The reason we know this is because these things that are described occur during the reign of Ahasuerus, who is king of Persia. Now, together with the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, which in the Hebrew canon is one book, Esther and Ezra and Nehemiah bring to close the Hebrew Bible. So, they mark the beginning of what is known as the intertestamental period, a period of darkness when there's no prophecy. So, Esther, along with Ezra and Nehemiah, stand in some respects as the last word that God gives to his church before the coming of Christ. Now, if Esther and Nehemiah speak to the hope of the Jews to return to Israel and to build the temple again, we can say as well that the book of Esther speaks to the Jews, but those who are in exile, those who are scattered among heathenish peoples and without any recourse or strength to be derived from their culture, their religion, or their institutions. They've been deprived all of this in their exile. As they say, this time period places the account near the start of the intertestamental period between the Old and New Testaments. And so, Esther, like Ezra and Nehemiah, are books upon which we find themes, I believe, that are hinging between the old Mosaic dispensation and the gospel dispensation of the covenant of grace. Now, we don't know for sure who the author of Esther's book was. But I think it is most likely Mordecai, who figures very large throughout the story. And we're going to see a lot of Mordecai in the pages of the book of Esther. It's also notable that in the book of Esther, we have presence of a number of Persian loan words, words derived from Persian words. Sometimes they've been Hebraized, sometimes they appear a little bit more directly. But these words, the presence of these words, indicates not only that the author was familiar with the Persian Empire, but he was familiar with the language of the Persian Empire. When the Persians took over, all of the administrative details would have been conducted in the Persian language. Now, this Ahasuerus reigned over Persia after Cyrus and Darius, the Medes. Darius was his father. And before Artaxerxes, who was his son. We see this in Ezra 4, verse 6, where he's mentioned in the middle, in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign. He's mentioned between Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes. Ahasuerus, contrary to what some commentators would assert, he's not the same as Artaxerxes. The fact is that Ahasuerus is almost certainly known in Greek writings as Xerxes the First. As I say, he was the son of Darius the First, Darius the Mede, and his wife Atossa, who was the daughter of Cyrus the Great. Now, despite his noble heritage, according to Herodotus, and Herodotus is an ancient historian, and he actually has something to say about this Xerxes the First. What he is most notable for in the secular history is his failed wars against the Greeks. Now, that's important. I want you to keep in mind, and I'm going to refer to this from time to time. We need to remember that according to the dream in Daniel, the Babylonian kingdom gives way to the Medo-Persian kingdom, and Medo-Persia will give way to the Greek kingdom. And so what Xerxes is doing is, in a sense, provocative. He's not so much securing his empire as sowing the seeds of future destruction and the translating of the throne of empire from the Persians then to the Greeks. He appears in the book of Esther as a man without really any opinion of his own. Even though he's a man who has sovereign rule, he has a complete rule, and these Oriental rulers could rule however they wish. He has tremendous power, and yet he is a man singularly notable for not having a mind of his own. The rabbis actually describe Ahasuerus as an axe in the hands of whoever wields him for either evil or good. And that's really, I think, a good way to think about this Ahasuerus, who he really is and what he's doing. It helps us, I think, understand a little bit more what's going on. And the reason he only reigns to the year 465 BC is he was eventually assassinated by the commander of the royal bodyguard with the assistance of one of the court eunuchs. Again, these are figures that we're going to see loom large in the book of Esther. What is notable is this, that Esther, the book of Esther, does not follow through to this event. In fact, it's not really concerned at all with the reign of Xerxes, except to the extent that this pagan king, as far as his reign has any effect on Israel, that's the extent to which the book of Esther is really concerned with Xerxes, Ahasuerus. Now, the name Ahasuerus in Hebrew is thought to mean the chief king or the king of kings. According to the rabbis, it actually bears another meaning. They understood it to mean brother to Rosh. And in Hebrew, Ach, brother, and Rosh, head. A brother to the head. And so what they understood by that is they understood this in terms of that dream revealed in Daniel's book, the dream of Nebuchadnezzar, who is the golden head of the image of his dream. So they understood him to be, in some sense, descended from Nebuchadnezzar. And certainly if we understand what's going on throughout the book, not only of Esther in terms of securing the throne and transmission of the throne and who sits on the throne, that theme is also, of course, in that dream of Nebuchadnezzar. But in that dream, we see that that throne is being transferred from Babylon to Medo-Persia to Greece to Rome and finally to Christ. So these heathen monarchs are really sitting in the throne that belongs to Messiah. The book of Esther contains what the Jews considered the great miracle. They thought Esther was the book of miracles. Even though there is no outward miracle ever performed in this book. There's no overt miracle. And yet they viewed it as a book of miracles. And their reasoning was that God does not perform overt miracles for the benefit of a people in exile. He's hidden from them. It's not that he's not there, but he's hidden from them. And that's an important theme, I think, to keep in mind. Esther contains a great miracle, the deliverance of the people of God, accomplished through a series of seeming coincidences. In fact, someone has said that if we didn't call it the Book of Esther, we might simply call it the Book of Coincidences. Because there are so many of them. The Jews say that there are 70 of them. 70 coincidences that make up the great miracle that leads to the deliverance of the people of God. Now, I think Esther has been brought in for a lot of criticism throughout the history of the church from time to time because it does not ever mention the name of God. In fact, the name of God and the presence of true religion is only overtly alluded to in those additions to the Book of Esther that you'll find in an Apocrypha that were added later, clearly, and they appear in Greek. They're not in Hebrew, so they're very clearly distinguishable from the original text. The absence of the name of God in the book, I think, is a demonstration that the people of God, living under a dynasty like that of the Persians, which would tolerate no other law than the law of the king, it's a way of saying they're not without hope. The Persians may not brook any mention of the name of the true God. The Persians may not observe any law other than the law of the pagan king. Under these oriental despots, the word of the pagan king might be the highest authority, the highest majesty imaginable. The fact is that no matter how pagan a kingdom, no matter how heathenish a people, no matter how detached a society may seem to be from true religion, the providence of God is still there. You can't escape the actions of the true and living God. Particularly, you can't escape the actions of the true and living God with respect to his people. If the Jews observe a law different from the king, they're accounted enemies. And so the fact is, the Book of Esther is not going to name the name of God. It's not going to be mentioned. And yet, amazingly, in Esther, I think we're reminded very, very clearly of these words that Solomon gives us in Proverbs 21. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of water, he turneth it whithersoever he will. There's an overruling providence which extends to even the most minute of things. I'm going to try to point out as we go through this book how often these little things, none of which would seem to matter, and yet all of which together make the great miracle that brings about the deliverance of God's people. Even the casting of the lot. So through a series of seeming unrelated events that are joined together providentially, the Lord turns disaster to victory, and the theme of Esther is this: gloom will be replaced with gladness. Now, what about Esther's name? Well, actually, she has two names. We'll start with the one most used in the book, and that is Esther. Esther means a star. And so this book is called, which is called by her name, stands, I think, as a light shining through the intertestamental era, looking toward the coming of Christ. It may be that she was given the name Esther because of the cult of worshiping of stars. And we're going to see the Persians were very interested in what the reformers would have called judicial astrology. We would simply call it astrology. Reading the stars, casting of horoscopes, and that sort of thing. But you see, Esther is showing these Persians that the stars themselves declare the glory of God. You cannot turn the providence of God, and you cannot read the secret decree of God simply through your horoscope. And so Esther is standing like a light, looking toward the coming of Christ, who himself is described as a star. We're told that he's a star coming out of Jacob in Numbers 24:17. I shall see him, but not now. I shall behold him, but not nigh. There shall come a star out of Jacob, and a scepter shall rise out of Israel, and shall smite the corners of Moab and destroy all the children of Sheph. The star, then, is language that has to do with the rule of Messiah. And in this book, we see the displacement that God is making providentially, how he's displacing the empires of the pagans to make way for the great kingdom of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Christ is called the bright morning star in Revelation 22:16. I, Jesus, have sent mine angel to testify unto you these things in the churches. I am the root and the offspring of David and the bright and morning star. He is the first thing that catches your eye coming out of the darkness. And so Esther's book leaves us at the beginning of that great darkness, prophetical darkness. There's no prophecy. There's no prophet. No one knows anything more as far as they know and as far as unbelieving Jews today hold. Esther contains some of the last words that God ever spoke to them. Now that's why when Christ is born, those who first sought him follow a star. Remember that in Matthew 2, verse 2? They say, where is he that's born King of the Jews? For we've seen his star in the east and are come to worship him. And by the way, this tells us that though the book of Esther is not directly quoted in the New Testament, it's one of only four or five books never directly quoted in the New Testament. The fact is this, the Magi that followed the star were very likely Persians. And that means that they were very likely familiar with a number of prophecies concerning Christ due to the presence of all of these exiled Jews who were in Persia. And that fact that there were exiled Jews that would have transmitted that information for this intertestamental period of darkness, that fact would not have been except that they were preserved from total destruction during the days of Esther, the star. Now, her Hebrew name is Hadassah, which means a myrtle. The myrtle is interesting because, first of all, the myrtle was given as an everlasting sign that the people of God should not be cut off. So in Isaiah 55, verse 13, instead of the thorn shall come up the fir tree, and instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle tree, and it shall be to the Lord for a name, for an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off. See, it's an assurance to the people of God that they're going to remain. And so again, this is a very appropriate name for her. It's certain that under Esther, the people of God are not going to be cut off, but they're going to be preserved from utter destruction. So this name, Hadassah, is very apropos. The myrtle is noted, secondly, for its fragrance, which It emits really only when it's crushed. Now, the Jewish commentary associated this with those who do good deeds but do not study the Torah. And there is a sense in which this is a theme we find in Esther. The Jews who are in exile are Jews who evidently are not studying Torah. Right? They're reliant upon the commands of Mordecai. They're ignorant of what to do. But that sweet smell, that fragrance that comes from the myrtle when it's crushed, you see, that's what happens when they face annihilation at the hands of their enemies. What do? They fast and they pray. They offer a sweet-smelling sacrifice to God, that sweet-smelling sacrifice of prayer, and it's turned to their good. So the crushing of the pride and the hope of Israel is the bringing forth of a sweet-smelling savor before God. The book of Esther holds forth a contest. And I want you to keep this in mind as we go through. That Ahasuerus is not only the monarch of one of these pagan kingdoms that will be displaced by Christ, but he is the representative of Satan on earth. And Mordecai is the representative of Christ on earth, who is mediating on account of his people. And Esther represents the voice of the faithful church, listening to the voice of the mediator and finding redemption through him. Verse 1. Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus. This is Ahasuerus, which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia over 127 provinces. The Hebrew begins with this phrase, now it came to pass in the days. What that means is the book of Esther begins with a construction, a Hebrew construction, that indicates that this story that we find appears to be part of some continuous narrative. In this, Esther's book actually closely resembles the beginning of the book of Jonah. Jonah begins using this construction, but like Jonah, Esther also indicates no previous narrative connection, which it continues. Esther is going to present a story which has precedent in the history of Israel, however. And so while it doesn't appear that there is an immediate context, the very beginning of the book is calling us to consider a broader and deeper context. You see, there's a familiarity to this story for all Jews that would hear it. And that is because it contains a lot that's reminiscent of the Exodus. A powerful king, Pharaoh, and a wise and godly deliverer, Moses. And they enter into a conflict. It's a religious conflict. It's a conflict over worshiping God. It's a conflict that ends with the people of God being saved, delivered out of the house of bondage. Now here in Esther, Ahasuerus is confronted by Mordecai. But unlike the Exodus, the deliverance, as I've noted, is not by a series of open miracles. The Exodus was accomplished through a series of astonishing miracles. But the deliverance under Mordecai and Esther, well, that's by a series of very muted, subtle providences. But because of this likeness, rather than unlikeness, the Jews actually equated these two men, saying that, in essence, Israel accepted the Torah, the law, under Moses, and that they accepted it once again under Mordecai. Likewise, the Jews believe that though all of the other books of Scripture could perish, neither the Torah, which was written by Moses, nor the book of Esther will ever perish. I think in this we can see at least an intimation that Esther may contain some hints of the gospel administration, though the connection might at first seem to you to be a little remote. The term "in the days" here is a usual term, by the way, for the reign of kings. We need to remember, they didn't count chronologically as we do, or as at least we seem to do. They counted using regal years. We do too, or at least we did until recently. We use the term AD, Anno Domini, the year of our Lord. That was a confession of regal years. We too use them. There's one Christian regal year. This is a common practice throughout societies. The Japanese to this day use that kind of accounting. They have an accounting that uses the year of such and such emperor. And that's how they count their years. So this is a term used for the reign of kings. However, there is a tradition that goes back at least to the time of the Great Synagogue, which states something like this. Whenever the scriptures begin with this complete phrase that we find here in Esther, "it came to pass in the days," that what is about to be described is a time of sorrow and distress. And I think that there's some reason to believe that this is at least partly correct. Consider Genesis 14:1. "And it came to pass in the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of nations. Ruth 1:1. "Now it came to pass in the days when the judges ruled that there was a famine in the land. And a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons." Or Isaiah 7:1. "And it came to pass in the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, king of Judah, that Razan, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, went up toward Jerusalem to war against it, but could not prevail against it." Or Jeremiah 1:3. It came also in the days of Jehoiakim, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, unto the end of the 11th year of Zedekiah, the son of Josiah, king of Judah, unto the carrying away of Jerusalem captive in the fifth month." All of those are verses which begin to tell a story of sorrow, a story of distress. But we need to keep this in mind, I think, as well. Genesis 14 may begin with the war of the kings of the east, but the story of the war with the kings of the east ends with Melchizedek blessing Abraham. Ruth 1 may begin with famine, but her story ends with the marriage of Ruth to Boaz and the establishing of the lineage of David, without whom there would be no Christ. Isaiah 7 begins with backsliding and idolatry, but in verse 14, it introduces the promise that a virgin shall conceive and bring forth a son. Jeremiah 1 begins with the misery and the trouble of Judah. But Jeremiah's prophecy goes on to speak of the branch, Christ, and to talk about the promise of redemption and restoration. In other words, each of these accounts that begins with this notion of an impending evil ends with a story of redemption. And so the rabbis who noted that missed the second part and point. It's from gloom to gladness, from sorrow to salvation. That's the theme. In the days of Ahasuerus, that Ahasuerus which reigned. Now, the seeming repetition tells us a couple of things. The first, I think, is this. It very clearly identifies the person who's under consideration here. Ahasuerus, who ruled. That's, in a sense, noting that he's the famous one. The one known in the histories, the secular histories, particularly of Herodotus, as Xerxes the First. Now, the Jews actually, they gather a different lesson from this repetition. And I think it's got a point. They say that it indicates the same Ahasuerus remains, that the Ahasuerus we're talking about doesn't change throughout the story. He doesn't change at all. He remains the same person throughout the course of this narrative. He's the same guy at the beginning as he is at the end. He's the same one at the end as he is at the beginning. All right, the construct, the reason they think this construct indicates this is because it is actually used to emphasize certain people are people either of vice or of virtue from the beginning to the end of their lives. And so Esau, instead of Esau, who is Edom in Genesis 36, verse 1. Same construction that's used here. Ahasuerus, who is Ahasuerus. Very same thing is used of Abram, who is Abraham in Genesis 17, 5. In other words, Edom doesn't simply become a person of vice later. He was the same person from beginning to end. And all that he affected. And the same with Abraham. He didn't just become a person of faith. He was elect from the foundation of the world. He is a man chosen of God. What is interesting about Ahasuerus is this. We have here a mighty ancient king who's going to act of his own free will in such a way that he often acts against his own will and thereby carries out the will of the Almighty. He does it voluntarily. He acts against his own initial inclinations. He acts against his own desires, but he does so freely. And he fulfills the decree of God. Now, this is both the greatness and the majesty of God, that he rules over the creature in such a way that the creature accomplishes the will of God both freely and, as our confession says rightly, necessarily. He accomplishes the will of God freely and necessarily. In the days of Ahasuerus, and Ahasuerus which reigned, or who ruleth. Who ruleth points to a couple of things. First of all, it teaches us that this Ahasuerus, though he is of royal descent, there's also a sense noted here, and the Jews, I think, rightly note that he took this power to himself. And the reason I think we know this is this. From the history, we understand Ahasuerus was not the oldest son of his father. And so he was not the one who had the right of primogeniture. He didn't have the right to occupy that throne first. And yet, the fact is that being born after the reign of Darius, when Darius commenced, he was only ever really familiar with the trappings of living at the very top of that Persian society, or that Median society. And after the death of his father, he is moved then very quickly to consolidate and assume the throne. And there are some indications that he even killed his own brother in order to secure the throne. He was not necessarily a nice man even before we see him in action in the Book of Esther. Which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia. And here's where we have, I think, the second thing about his ruling. He actually, we are made to understand here, he actually exercises this rule which he took, at least as a figurehead. Because remember, he doesn't really seem to have a mind of his own. He's like a will without a mind. Now, this which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, this phrase is not given here to teach us that the events of the book of Esther occur during the time when Ahasuerus is reigning over this territory. The fact is, his father Darius reigned over most, if not all, of this extensive kingdom. In Daniel 6:1, we read, "It pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 princes, which should be over the whole kingdom." These are 120 satraps. These are the people that would be administering these districts. And that's really what is in view, these various countries that are divided into districts and so on. Darius had actually set up, if you remember, Daniel was one of three that were over all of these 120. There were three. They were presidents, I think the King James calls them, that were set over these 120. And so they're going to oversee presumably 40 of these countries or administrative provinces. So the point of bringing this up is not to say that all of a sudden Ahasuerus came into this. He inherits this, evidently. The reference instead is really meant to show the extent of Ahasuerus' kingdom. The kingdom of the Persian Empire is so vast, and that's the idea here, it's so vast that, as was once said of the British Empire, the sun never sets on it. Right? The sun never set over the whole of the kingdom. Literally, we would say his power extends from the rising of the sun to the going down of the same. And that places his empire, his kingdom, in direct opposition to the kingdom of the coming Christ, who in Psalm 72, verse 8, it is prophesied, "He shall have dominion also from sea to sea, and from the river unto the ends of the earth." And note that word, "from the river unto the ends of the earth," because the word translated India, hudu, that word only appears here in Esther. It's likely taken from the Zendic Hindu, or Hindu. And what it denotes is the seven rivers of the Indus Valley. So from the rivers until the ends of the earth. This man is occupying territory that Messiah will rule over. The word translated Ethiopia is the word Cush. So he reigned from the borders of Cush, the far reaches of India. 127 provinces. Now, if you're wondering, remember the Darius appoints 120 princes over the territories. Persia proper, consisted of seven divisions, which when you add to the other 120 countries, makes 127 that are mentioned here. Now, this Esther, who is descended from Sarah, whose name means princess, Sarah, if you remember, she lived to be 127 years old. And so Esther has a kingdom that reflects that same number. And because of that, the rabbis noted this, that Sarah had lived a full life. She hadn't wasted any time. They said had she wasted a day or an hour, Esther might have lost a city. And had she wasted a year, it might have been a whole country. Now, whether or not this is the case, this is a good reminder that the lives that we live do have future consequences. We're not only exerting an influence while we're alive, but there are, in fact, residual effects of our lives that will be felt down through the future. After all, had Sarah not been faithful, she wouldn't have brought forth Isaac. And had there been no Isaac, there would have been no Esther, for whom this deliverance is appointed. And there would have been no Jews that would have needed this deliverance. So, we have an account of the ruler from whom all the events which follow flow. Persia is, as I said, like all the kingdoms that are represented in Nebuchadnezzar's dream, it's a despotism. Persia is an oriental tyranny. That's the kind of government we have. And if you keep that in mind, you'll understand better some of the things that we're going to read going on in this kingdom and in this palace. So we have an account of the ruler, and next we're told of the place in this vast kingdom where the deliverance arises. That in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace. In those days is a resumption of thought. But now the thought and focus of the narrative is upon the time wherein this deliverance proceeds, and the place in which the catalyst for the turn of events occurs. So the fact is this. It's very likely that Ahasuerus, the reigning king, had several places where he would, from time to time, go throughout the year. But we're told specifically where he goes at this time and why. That is, the why in this case has to do with the deliverance of the people of God. We're not necessarily told why he is there from his point of view. We can speculate, and I will in a moment, but that doesn't really figure in. Again, it's notable that the book of Esther is not concerned at all with the heathen kingdom, except as the facts and figures in this heathen kingdom impact the people of God. In those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom. Now there's some thought here among the rabbis that this is referring to him making sure his throne. But as the story of Esther unfolds, I think it's important that we remember that we're given a picture here of this king, but there's another king whose name remains hidden in the book of Esther, who is also seated upon the throne. He's seated upon the throne of his kingdom, which is an everlasting kingdom. And so there is this very subtle juxtaposing of this throne that is, I think, designed to remind us of a much higher authority and a much higher reigning than that of Ahasuerus. As I say, Ahasuerus is moving around and probably has several thrones that he moves from season to season. It's with this series of events that begins to unfold here that set in motion the salvation of the people of God. So the translation of the monarchies is outlined in Daniel, Babylon, Media, Persia, Greece, and Rome. And they're going to make all of them are going to make way for the throne of him whose right it is to rule, as I say, the Son of God, Jesus Christ. So we're being reminded of this here, that there is another throne that's being established, that this throne is going to be moved out of the way to establish this everlasting throne. When he sat on the throne of the kingdom, which was in Shushan the palace. Here is a palace which existed at least from Cyrus' day. That's at least what we have. We have some knowledge of this, again, I believe, from Herodotus. This is not something that Ahasuerus builds. It's something that was built. Shushan took its name from the lily that was found in the vicinity of this palace. It was called the Shushan. The Medes and the Persians, actually, it turns out, had learned it was best to rule over subjugated people from places other than their own capital. So Nebuchadnezzar might have stayed at the center of Babylon, but the Medes and the Persians, which is why Cyrus builds this, evidently, is their plan is to have various capitals so that they would not provoke nationalist sympathies all the time. So if you see the king sometimes closer to you in a province or country closer to you, it's a little less offensive than if he's way over there on the east coast. Shushan was in Elam, which, though outside of their national boundaries, was still decidedly within the part of the Persian Empire that enjoyed relative peace. The term palace here actually refers to the castle or the walled fortress wherein the throne was situated and where the king sat. At this point, the Jews note the mercy of God toward his righteous people. And again, I think rightly so. It's the change of seasons which is moving Ahasuerus to Shushan. And Shushan, as we're going to see, is where we find Mordecai residing. So rather than telling his servant Mordecai to go to the king, like we have in Jonah, already we see the king is being moved for the fulfilling of divine purposes. In fact, everything it has already been set in place and in motion without even notifying Mordecai yet. And Ahasuerus, the fact is, as I said, he's going to do what he's going to do, and he's going to do it freely and necessarily. Without revealing himself to the pagan king, then, God moves the monarch. And this plan, providentially, goes back so far that there had even been an arrangement that a royal palace be built in Shushan so that Mordecai is going to be near this king. Verse 3. In the third year of his reign, he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, nobles and princes of the provinces being before him. Now, in the third year of his reign is an important marker for us in terms of what we know outside of Scripture. Because Herodotus notes that it was during the second year after the death of Darius that King Xerxes I was forced to go into Egypt to put down a rebellion. And that got him thinking about securing this kingdom. In fact, in the third year, the ancient historian tells us, Xerxes returns and calls together his council of princes in order to have a consultation and to make known his own views with respect to to his plan. His plan. Again, Esther's not concerned with why he returned at this time. But it's simply interested in recording the fact that has bearing on the salvation of the Jews. He did return. And that would have been about the year 483 BC. By the way, this is also most likely the third year after the interruption of the building of the temple. Go back to Ezra 4, verse 6, where we read, "And in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they unto him an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem." This is because the temple building had ceased. There was an interruption. And so, this is one of the things, one of the reasons the Jews think that this feast is being called in celebration, perhaps, of this. We're told in the third year of his reign he made a feast unto all his princes and his servants. So here's a feast where he calls his courtiers. That's what they were, courtiers. The word translated feast refers to a drinking bout. It's a banquet. And the emphasis of this feast is then to be on the consumption of wine. Now, again, so far as Esther is concerned, the book of Esther, the secular accounting for this feast is not important. The book makes no mention of it. Its only interest to Esther, the book of Esther, is because it's another piece of what we will see is an increasingly complex maze of providential puzzle pieces that lead to the delivery of Israel. Victory over Egypt, and which is what happened when Xerxes went down and put down that rebellion. Victory over Egypt and any matters that pertain to maintaining or expanding or securing the empire, they're only pretexts that God presents to the heathen king to move him to call this feast. But it's not really what's going on. He may think that that's what's really going on. He may actually think that this is what needs to be done, and probably does. But all of this is so that Ahasuerus does what he does, both freely and necessarily. I mean, from a secular point of view, it's most likely Ahasuerus' purpose in calling the feast was to raise support for his campaign against the Greeks. He's going to war against Macedon, who eventually is going to defeat the Persian Empire. And that campaign against the Greeks is going to end with an ill-fated assault upon Athens. It's not going to be good, which is why he is not remembered well by the secular historians. Made a feast unto all his princes and his servants, the power of Media and Persia. The reign of the Persians is not without its complications. Not everything is as it seems. The Persians, when they conquer the Medes, when they get the upper hand in that Median-Persian empire or kingdom, they bestowed upon the Medes, the conquered Medes, great respect, and they even shared a lot of power with them. In fact, the Medes were brought into places of power and trust, holding some of the highest offices in the empire or kingdom. The nobles and princes of the provinces, the nobles here are called first men. The term that's used is actually derived from Persian language. And this would include the various rulers over the 127 provinces as they're gathered together for the great war against Greece. These men and the capacity, and we'll see this to some extent, they're functioning a lot like Roman senators function later. Their job, their place, their position is to give advice and consent to the plans of the monarch. But you see, the presence of copious amounts of alcohol is probably meant here to ensure not so much that they give genuine advice and consent, but rather that they rubber stamp the king's point of view, that his view would prevail in this great meeting. However, nothing in the book of Esther is as it appears. Nobles of the princes of the province appear before him. And all these were gathered before Ahasuerus. But that final clause in this verse also reminds us that there's another king watching all of this unfold. And this king who's watching this unfold is the only king who actually has the wisdom and the power to conduct all of these affairs to a much different end than any of the participants of this drunken, debauched banquet would ever suspect. Now, it is the case in Esther that this king remains silent before the heathen. And yet, all the while, for those of us who are looking beyond appearances, mere appearances, we see that this king is making them willing to do his good pleasure again and again. So the first verse tells us who. The second verse tells us where. And this third verse tells us when. So I think we can see in this introduction that we have a very carefully constructed and crafted introduction. The author of the book wants to give us some very specific starting points so that we can understand from whence the events which unfold arise. Each of these who, where, when, each of these factors is determined by the hand of him whose name is still unnamed by observant Jews. Now observe on all of this. God has raised up this heathen king. God has placed him at the head of the most powerful empire in the world. This king, who is in fact himself descended from royalty, he's no stranger to the machinations of intrigue. He's seen it before, and he'll see it again. He is, as I said, in many respects, a typical Oriental monarch ruling with an absolute power. And yet, in the case of the Persians, there has been a little bit of a shift. This power has to proceed with a certain care to make it appear to be shared. Now, this Ahasuerus apparently knows to be the most effective way to rule, to rule with the consent of his courtiers. And so what he does is he arranges a banquet, a drinking bout. He arranges all of this so that he makes his courtiers willing to do his bidding. He is careful himself to introduce wine, through the drinking of which he hopes to stir up their spirits to a course of predetermined action. Ahasuerus' designs, whatever they might be, his designs are limited and they're bounded by his humanity. But you see, the interesting thing about this story is that he himself is again and again shown to us and shown to all who are the people of God to be subject to a greater king who is going to make him willing to do what's necessary for the salvation of Israel. We're told that his kingdom is vast, perhaps half of the known world or more. It's indicated that his power in this kingdom is felt in the farthest reaches, often without the men in those provinces even knowing what or why they're being told to do. However, all of this itself is subject to a greater power, a universal reign, a kingdom that is far more vast than anything than he that he could imagine. A power so much greater that it doesn't need wine or some sort of artificial stimulant to move people. A power whose very touch can reach every heart, but illuminates only those who are his called and elect people. This is a story of a conflict. It's the conflict between good and evil. But it is one in which evil is evil precisely because it is not determined to that which is good continually. It's a mindless willing that will lend itself to anything in order to retain power. It's a story of the conflict between light and darkness, wherein those who are in darkness don't know that they're blind, and those who are in light await the day star to arise. And so with that, Esther sets before us now the three major points from which this plot proceeds. And there we have it. Ahasuerus goes strutting onto the scene. Ahasuerus moves into the history that affects the people of God with all of the pride that attends heathen rulers. And he should remember the words of Solomon, whose throne he sought to emulate. Pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. And that is the theme of Esther as we see it unfold. Amen.